No, the story, it's an old story, you've probably heard it before, but it's worth retelling. Of the student who showed up for the first day of his college class and decided that he needed to start with the class that he could experience some success in. And so decided to take a course in, I believe it's called ornithology, study of birds. You know this story? Ornithology, thank you. You know the story?
No.
So he had the class the first day and decided that since this was going to be one of those that he took as an elective, that he was thinking it would be a pretty easy class and wouldn't have to buy too many textbooks and could get through it real easily. He came in and the first thing the professor did is to say, put your notebooks and your books underneath the table. Got a little bit worried about that. Next thing the professor did is he put 12 pictures of bird legs around the course of the room. And said, 10% of your grade will come from the pop test, and this is your first pop test. I want you to look at the pictures that are around the room, and the legs of these birds, and tell me, name the birds that you see pictured here. Of course, he was flabbergasted and furious, and said, what do you mean to give us this kind of test with 10% of it counting for our grade? We've had no study yet, you haven't given us any instruction. The professor said, sit down, son. He said, I'm not going to sit down. I can't believe that they even enrolled in this class. The professor angrily said, sir, sit down or tell me who you are. To which he said, you tell me. Well, probably not a true story and not all that funny, but it does ask the question that we want to address today. And that is the question of who am I? The study of identity and the question of identity. One that Erickson said we raise throughout the whole course of our life, and therefore one that has deep significance for us, I think, in our spiritual journeys as well. Welcome. I'm Chris Keesling, and I'm a graduate of Asbury from 1990. Yeah, left in 89, graduated in 90. Served a little bit in a campus ministry position out in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. Never heard of Arkadelphia before I was there, but served two campus ministries and also pastored a little rural church, and then had an opportunity to return home to pastor in a multi-staff church, United Methodist Church, back in my home in West Texas, at the Bow Bay to prison, and pastored out there with a pastor named Jim Jackson, who's now down at the church at Chapelwood, and so served on that church about 4 or 5 years, and then did graduate school at Texas Tech. Kind of convenient for me while I was there, and found that there were those in my congregation who were finding that those who were steeped in the social sciences had a way of speaking to them and unpacking portions of their life story in ways that, that those folks were becoming mentors and spiritual guides and therapists and taking on a role of authority in their lives. More so in some ways than pastors and others were. And so I decided that it was worth spending some time in graduate school, getting steeped in the social sciences and trying to say, how do these interface together? How can one inform the other? And what can we learn and critique about the journeys that, that people are taking? And so I spent 4 or 5 years in graduate school studying human development and family studies. And really thinking about it being supplemental and to what I was doing in parish ministry. And so didn't expect to be in an academic role, but and in some ways said, rather than asking the question of what could I do my dissertation on that would become something that would be valuable to the church, it was how can I get out of this program and stay alive? And identity development seemed to be of interest to me, so I spent my dissertation interviewing 30 adults, both Protestants and those from different faith traditions. So there were a couple of Muslims in my study, Catholic, atheist, and a Wiccan. So trying to learn something about, is there any commonality in terms of the way they structured their spiritual identity, and what was different about the content of their spiritual identity? So we'll unpack some of that today. I want to introduce you to my colleague, Dr. Jim Hampton, soon to be Dr. Jim Hampton. Jim is on sabbatical this semester working on his dissertation in kind of looking at, Jim comes from a Nazarene background and is focused on the belief system. How do the things that youth purport to believe integrate with the alignment in their life in terms of the way that they're living out those beliefs? Is that a fair assessment, Jim? And Jim taught the first part of this section on who am I and on identity earlier this week. Let me see, how many, anybody here that was with us during that time? Okay, just a few of you got that, that background. Jim's been with us for a year. He comes from the Nazarene Publishing House, created his own webpage and youth ministry resources. And I just tell you, I've been delighted to have Jim as a colleague. He's got stars all over him, and we can't wait for him to finish his dissertation. If you've got folks that are going into youth ministry, send them to us. The next few years, we'll be putting together some things that I think will just be dynamite. And Jim's a great one to for them to be apprenticed under. Ask Jim if he would open up our time in prayer for us.
Gracious God, we are so thankful for the opportunity to come and to learn, the opportunity to be stressed and to allow you to not only give us new information, but to give us new information. We ask today that as we embark upon this coming together, that you would enable each of our minds and hearts to be open. Help us be discerning critics. Help us most importantly, Father, to hear the truth that only you can hear. And that we thank you in this time.
Amen. Jim, thank you. And again, any time during the course of this presentation that we can draw from your wisdom as well, there's a wisdom in a host of counselors. And so maybe you can even get two seminars in one if we have Jim talking to us. I'd like to just ask a couple of questions about who you are. I taught this, this is only my second ministry conference to do, and we started with introductions last time, and I gave away too much time. So we're going to do this real quickly. Just want to see, how many senior pastors do we have here? Most of you? Okay. Other ministry roles that folks are in? Yes.
Music director.
Music director, good. Okay. Youth minister, okay. Other roles? Let me ask, how many of you, anybody here for whom this is a first Asbury Seminary Ministry Conference or Ministry Experience? Wow, fantastic. Welcome. Hope you'll be back and hope this is a good experience for you. And then let me ask also, how many of you would be familiar with Eric Erickson's theory of psychosocial development? Okay. Had some background in developmental psychology? A little bit? Okay, good. We'll hit that quickly then and jump into to some other things. Let me get us started, just kind of a reflective exercise. My background was looking at lifespan human development. And I think what I've been about for about the last 7 or 10 years is trying to say, if we took the entirety of the lifespan and began to say, what are the developmental tasks that folks face at every stage of that lifespan? And then begin to ask the question of what's the theological construct or theological understanding that we can bring to people at that particular section of their lifespan to help them make meaning of it, to think theologically about it, to be formed spiritually in that particular time, what would it look like? Now, I want to do just a quick historical, sociological kind of overview and notice the changes that impact our sense of self, our sense of identity that have happened perhaps over the last 80 to 100 years. I think it was, who was the fellow that started the, Ben Campbell Johnson, that started the Lay Witness Mission? Some of you remember the Lay Witness Mission. I heard him say one time that there's a difference between a white preacher when he comes to preach and a black preacher when he comes to preach. And the difference is that when the black preacher comes to preach, they always know that the congregation is bringing half the message. So I'm expecting you today to bring half the message. I know that there are life experiences and your own readings and your own journeys into issues of spiritual formation. They're as rich as some of the things that I can teach. And so I want us to conceptualize the learning environment, not as an expert that's pouring down information, but to say, here's the profound reality of identity. Let's put it in the middle of where we are, and let's all talk about it and bring what we can to the table to look at it. I want to introduce you, first of all, to a study that came out of a little book called The Postmodern Life Cycle. Let me go ahead and put these handouts for you out. And this has got... the reference on the back up here if you wanted to look at some of the things that we'll mention and talk about. At a conference, I came across a little book by Friedrich Schweitzer, who teaches at the University of Tübingen, and he gives an illustration of a study that he came across that I tried to find, but I had to type in the letters, the words in German, and I didn't know pretty quickly whether or not I was anywhere close to the study itself. So I've replicated some of the pictures that are probably not his original ones. They don't fit exactly, but I think they illustrate well for us where I want to go. Let me describe the picture. The first picture is Dr. Schweitzer mentions it, and then have you reflect on it a little bit. He says, if you could imagine the first scene being in the 1930s, 10 people in the picture, men and women, children and adults, that clearly belong to three different generations. Two things keep them busy together. They're taking a break from harvesting a field, and they're sharing a meal consisting of simple sandwiches and something to drink, which is poured from a simple pitcher. The impression that the scene leaves on the observer is far from neutral. The whole situation is highly evocative, breathing peacefulness and also a certain gratitude. The people are enjoying each other. They're not very rich, but they seem to have what they need. They're content. The background of this picture is an agricultural society, family life here. Sharing a meal in the fields is integrated with work. People are working together and they're eating together, and everything is happening more or less in the same place. There are no long-distance commutes. Three different generations are present on an everyday basis. Moreover, all of them are actively participating in the same task of working the fields. I couldn't find, the exact picture, but I found one that's close to it. So I want to just reflect a little bit in terms of the picture that's represented here. And let's just highlight again a few of the things that are here. Notice the people in the situation in the picture. 8 of them. How many generations are present? Would you guess?
At least three.
Maybe 4. What are the daily tasks that this family is about? Would you guess? If you were to read into the picture. Okay, farmers. Food preparation, okay. Mostly done together. If you were to take, say, this fella, and he was to ask himself, how do I fashion an identity? What do you think would be his primary reference points? What would determine that? Okay. Even dresses a lot like his dad. So if he was going to ask, who can I likely expect to become like? More than likely, he's going to look to his dad. So it's, in a sense, there's a continuity between the generations. And there's a sense in which looking backwards gives me a sense of looking forward. Okay? The domains of work and family life, mealtime preparation, likely spent together. What determines the role that these people play? Okay? All right. So the gender that they're born into? Yeah?
Their age.
Their age to some extent? Okay. Something that they're free to construct, or is it something that's fairly predetermined for them? Say again?
Their economic.
Economic? Okay. Yeah, the economics certainly determine how much freedom they have within those particular roles.
The environment drives some of that role, I would think.
Okay. Say a little bit more.
What needs to be done.
Okay.
It's got to be done, and you know, who's available to and capable of doing it.
Okay, great. Other observations that you make of just thinking about the picture or seeing into it, behind it?
Yeah, depend on weather, too.
Okay. Yeah. My father grew up on the farm and decided there was too much uncertainty connected to the farm life for him to stay there, so. He was raising a pig for 4-H, and the pig died. And he decided to go to college because he couldn't handle the heartbreak of that experience.
One thing about it, being farmers, they had more than an 8-hour work day.
Okay.
So that, I mean, if you know anything about farming, especially if you have animals, you're up before dawn.
All the time.
And when the sun goes down, you're still in the barn.
Closest friends or your family on a farm.
Okay, your social reference point is all your family. Yeah, closest friends of the family.
Stable family situation.
Okay, stable. Yeah, what other words would you associate with it? terms of, if you were going to ask, what affective kind of feel is there to being in this picture? How do you feel about yourself? What kind of things do you evoke?
You have a place.
Okay, you got a place? Yeah, place is an interesting kind of notion. Now, Wendell Berry heard one time described that, you know, getting married used to mean that you were establishing a literal physical place. And that now in mobility, people don't have the freedom of actually saying, this is my place, carving out this place in society. I thought it was a very interesting place. I'm sorry, what did you?
Contented,
yeah. There's a kind of a peacefulness about this. Sense of contentment. That comes, what would you think it comes from? Okay. There's a place of stability. Stability?
Predictability.
Okay. Yeah.
And those are the same thing every, if you're into that mindset, you're there.
Yeah. Same thing.
Sense of
security. Good.
Sense of being needed.
Yeah. Because of the domestic agricultural task.
Proliferation.
Say a little bit more about that. That's an interesting term I would have thought of.
The more kids you have, the more workers you have on the
farm. Okay. The creation mandate. Be fruitful and multiply. We've done it well. Okay. Well, let's go ahead to a second picture. Schweitzer puts this at the 1950s. Anybody recognize the make and model? I think that's right. I didn't know it. But he uses this as a symbolic picture of the modernization of family life. Because if you notice, first of all, even though this is a pretty classy looking car, cars in the 1950s probably weren't made for so much for appearance or status. Maybe they were to some extent. They were made for mobility. And so Schweitzer is holding up this picture to say in the 1950s, notice how many seats are in the car. Why that many? Okay, big family, but the ideal family probably consisted at this stage of life is what?
One father, two children.
Okay, two or three children. So the car was designed to hold the idealization of the nuclear family. So if we compared it to the last picture, the grandparents are no longer here. I remember I was born in 63, and we had the station wagon. Again, not a car that was designed primarily for the sleek appearance. But it allowed us always to go on family vacation. And there was oftentimes this sense then of taking the family somewhere in order to perhaps do family vacation. Is that where meaning was determined for the family? And again, what's different from this picture in terms of the previous picture? What other things might be shaping identity? It might be different between the two pictures.
Less rural.
Less rural. Okay. More mobility, which became vastly significant even in terms of our dating patterns when the car arrived. Listened to a tape not too long ago from Mars Hill, and it was suggesting that quite often dating patterns used to be that you would do courting, and it was socially regulated by the adults. So you would essentially come and you would court in the front of the what were they called? The parlor, yeah, in the parlor. And apparently you knew pretty quickly whether or not you were, how you were doing. Because again, the adults were regulating all, with the automobile, all of that became a private, personal kind of affair between the two that were there. There were few social regulations to it, few models for guiding and directing it. Okay, good. Is that right? that's a good point, yeah. Yeah, with the lights switching on and off on the porch, or
yeah.
Okay.
Well, at that point there was probably just one car in the family. Mm-hmm. So the use of the kids were regulated.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be in, right?
Yeah. Helpful comment. One car in the family. So primarily to take the man to work. Oftentimes. Maybe a little bit stereotyped. Okay. Yeah. So this is post-World War II, two generation, where all the changes that happened in the lifespan. If we were going to ask the question of what does the lifespan mean at this point? How might you characterize it? And how might it be different again from from the previous picture.
Well, since the work wasn't as physically taxing, the lifespan would probably increase.
Okay.
People would be, they would live longer.
Good. Good. Yeah, first of all, one of the interesting things is that most of our developmental models had development happening up until about adulthood, which you would arrive at about 18. And now I guess after that, it's kind of downhill. Now our models are such that the lifespan continues to expand. And so we're talking about, some folks are even talking about a third age now, that beyond retirement, people are starting whole new life structures and doing creative kinds of things. It's a whole new life that begins beyond retirement. So fascinating kind of thing.
In the 50s, early 50s, we were beginning a transition from agrarian culture to an industrial culture, which we have continued, and now we're changing again. But that was the beginning of the industrial culture.
Great.
People going off the farm and getting jobs in factories.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so we've got in this early picture this combination of work and family at home, and now all of a sudden in the 50s we start to get this separation where you go off to your work and the family's doing something else, and so those work less hours. Okay, so more time for leisure. Yeah, good.
You already alluded to it, and it always has an effect on the family, and that is war.
Mm-hmm.
Because some are killed. Alters a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And as Fred just said, we were moving into an industrial thing, but part of that came from the war effort, the Second World War, which then moved in. Housing has changed a great deal after the Second World War. Like my father said, they put up a bunch of sandboxes. There were housing developments. Drew people closer together, not necessarily socially, but physically.
Mm-hmm. Good. It's a good segue to our third picture, that flight that holds up again with automobiles, but now suggests that two Beamers, his and hers, and just reminds me that at least the way the developmental story seems to be told is that with a lot of the men away at war, the women went into the workforce. And lo and behold, they did well. And some of them chose to stay. And so we had the changing of the gender roles that emerged. Interesting that we'll mention Erikson's theory in just a minute. Erikson built on Freud. Freud became, in his heyday, largely because of the post-traumatic stress syndrome associated with the war. And psychology was suddenly called upon to try to help men returning from war. And so so the unconscious kind of things that Freud was into probably created the context for his theory to become such renowned. Well, here's the third picture that Schweitzer holds up and mentions that two cars. So you've got the family moving in different directions more and more now. In fact, it's been amazing to me to see that in a capitalist society, men and women are oftentimes, the market economy itself is not very friendly to the family. And oftentimes what the capitalist society asks for is for people to be mobile. And so first of all, as you know, you've got your congregations that, 50% of it turns over about every 3 or 4 years? Kind of the reverse of the circuit rider model. If you stay long enough, you'll have a new congregation that comes through. But you've also got oftentimes with both husband and wife working, that they can be not only headed two different directions in the morning, they can actually be living in different locations. And so it's not uncommon to have folks that spend half the day separated from each other, or even 6 months. Even occasionally that I met folks who the husband's overseas for some kind of time, and the big changes in the life cycle. What's happened between, what does this family do together? Christmas. Which may not be a pleasant time. Okay. And what is shaping identity? What's the reference for identity at this point?
Something beyond the home.
Okay. Oftentimes beyond the home?
Something that's being lost. The person's self-identity.
Okay.
They're struggling to find out who they are.
And so there, and there's less of a process of reclamation? Is that kind of what I'm hearing you say? Okay.
There's a movement towards specialization, which kind of pigeonholes a person into a little box that I would think would contribute to the frustration of whole people, which you see angry people then. And the separatedness becomes more separated.
Mm-hmm.
So the children are your focus together then, and that's all you can do together, go to kids' baseball games.
Yeah, when Jim taught his seminar, he mentioned that that the youth subculture is almost a subculture that's excluding more and more adults from it. And we may even be fostering that some in the way that we do programming in the church. And you have to ask yourself the question, as Heinrich Nouwen said in one of his books, what happens with the fatherless generation? Where do they turn? Largely to the peer group. And the peer group becomes that which creates the sense of self for them. So here we've got essentially no longer the connection of work and family. We've got parents going in different directions, and where does it leave the child with the sense of reference? We also have the, if you were to compare these pictures, little choice, perhaps, as we were mentioning in the first picture, in terms of the roles that a person would play. It was pretty much predetermined before they were there. In the second one, there may have been some choice of do I work or do I go to school, education versus home life. Here you've got the multiplication of choice, almost an assault with the possibilities. And what happens when you're forced with what some sociologists call over-choice? It's kind of the same phenomenon that you have when you go to an all-you-can-eat. What do you do when, you ever notice how those things kind of look like a feed trough anyway? but it's paralyzing to have so many choices.
Disrupting. You have his and her. That's the society we have. When I counsel young people to get married, they always have his and her, not ours.
Huh? Huh.
So the farm family still had ours. It was our farm, not his farm, not my farm. It was our farm. Even in the 50s, we still had that mentality. Mm-hmm. But now we have this mentality. It's mine. It's his and hers, and it's not ours.
Yeah.
And even the children are like that now.
Very interesting comment, and I think it's Schweitzer who also mentions that that if you were to name, how do you find meaning in the lifespan? That at this point, lifespan becomes a matter of personal achievement. And so it may be very much connected to this sense of this is mine, and in fact, in terms of what parenting looks like. It may be that the reason we get this kind of movement away from the family is because there is a sense of obligation to fulfill what it is that that I'm particularly called to be. Now, there may be good things and bad things about that, but there's not the sense in which the family, less of a sense, maybe I should say, of the family sacrificing for the sake of the children. Yeah. Self-denying to a self-fulfilling kind of role.
I don't know if you're planning to go into this, but certainly our communications have changed.
Okay.
With the technology bringing in... everything used to be face-to-face, and then we started to get the telephone, and that expanded it, and now we're down to cell phones, and my son-in-law went to Iraq and just picked up his cell phone, called his wife back in Tennessee, just like it was next door.
Astonishing.
So that, in some ways, tends to divide people because we don't have this face-to-face communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, helpful comment.
Also brings a lot more distraction into our line of food through the internet. So
distraction or destruction?
Destruction.
Yeah, yeah. Bombarded by messages all the time. And but also gives us access to other people's stories. So it, in terms of the way, the impact that it has upon identity, I think it's multifaceted. Let me see if I can push this ahead a little bit. I want to, in the first little bit that we've got together, to give you at least a theoretical framework. One of the people who tried to conceptualize identity across the lifespan was Eric Erickson. And Erickson, as many of you know, had a theory that he developed, in which oftentimes referred to as the eight stages of life. I want to walk you through this just real quickly, then I'll give you a break, and we'll come back and see if we can unpack identity development within those stages a little bit further. Let's say we start at 1:30. Y'all ought to be good for a few more minutes anyway, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay. It's like we started at 1, so I was going to get you breaking quickly. Erickson built upon Freud, but Erickson, in particular, focused upon psychosocial development. That is, whereas Freud was psychosexual and raises all sorts of questions for me in terms of his particular theory, Erickson was psychosocial. That is, very much focused upon how is it that the social interactions that we experience, the relationships that we're in, the primary people in our life, how do they begin to shape our identity? Again, we can only go back and compare the pictures to see the changes in terms of who are the primary players in one social context, and how do they shape a sense of ourselves, a sense of our identity. So you can see that throughout the 8 stages of life that Erickson named, that there were always there's a growing radius of folks who are part.